From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the Akashic Records. Looking forward to that. Here's what's happening. Hundreds of passengers on a British cruise to North America have fallen ill with norovirus. According to the CDC, 252 of the 919 passengers on board the Balmoral cruise ship had stomach virus since leaving the United Kingdom. Not fun. Most of those on board are British. It is now docked in Portland, Maine, and then leaving for St. John in the Canadian province of New Brunswick. Not a happy situation on that ship. A 17-year-old pregnant girl from Connecticut whose Zika diagnosis was confirmed last week is requesting people's financial help through a GoFundMe page because she has decided to keep the baby. At approximately 10 weeks of gestation, the baby is at high risk of having cerebral damage. As of tonight, the page Care for Baby Zika Infection at GoFundMe has raised $615. Islamic State militants reportedly shot and killed a 7-year-old Syrian boy, reportedly in front of his sobbing parents, all because he let a few curse words slip out of his mouth. An activist told the news agency that the boy was arrested after they heard him cursing divinity while playing in the street with his friends. The Federal Reserve's debate over whether to raise U.S. interest rates in June may be decided in the coming week as investors look for any cracks in China and evidence of a solid start to the second quarter in the United States. Let's check in with the expert on the economy, Catherine Austin Fitz. Are the rates going to go up next month, Catherine? What do you think?
I think they're going to be reluctant to bump it. The pressure is on, absolutely, to bring interest rates up, George. But if you look at the global slowdown in the economy, I just don't think there's a lot of oomph.
They're hoping for a great second quarter. I don't know. What are you hearing?
I don't see any signs.
Nothing.
I don't know where it comes from. And I think the big concern, of course, is China, because you've got the global debt model all over the world coming to an end. And so the question is, where are you going to get growth? And, of course, there's a real problem on managing the debt, and China is the number one issue.
China's having some issues at home, too, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. They're trying to relax their currency controls so that they can globalize the currency, but they've seen a very significant outflow of capital during the last few quarters. And I think there's a real balance here between achieving the reform that they want to get and getting the globalization that they want to get and keeping the balance of the capital, you know, sort of in not seeing a rush for the door by Chinese. By both foreign investors and by Chinese the wealthy. So I think there's a real issue of how China's going to do over the next three quarters and how they're going to manage the debt. They've grown the debt tremendously, and at this point it's really dangerous to keep growing it at the same rate.
Catherine Austin Fitz, website Solari.com. Thank you, Catherine. Now, here's a fascinating story. You know, the story we talked about last week, that massive wildfire that forced the evacuation of almost 90,000 people in Alberta province in Canada, is now showing signs of slowing down thanks to the hard work of the firefighters and a turn in the weather. A cold front did not bring yet the expected showers, but the area did see lower temperatures and more humidity, and that helped a lot. Ironically, we talked about intention last week of trying to bring some rain and changing weather to that region. I'm not going to say we succeeded, but something weird is happening. Thought we'd check in with Reverend Michael Carter, expert on intention. Michael, what do you think of this? When we talk about it and we get millions of people to think about it, and then something strange does happen after a few days. Did we have an effect or not on that?
Well, George, first of all, it's good to hear from you. And to answer that question, yeah, I think we do influence these events. Wayne Dyer wrote a wonderful book back a few months ago. Well, he passed away, but he wrote a wonderful book maybe about two or three years ago called The Power of Intention. And we must remember that intention is an act of the will. It's different from prayer in the sense of we are not waiting for some deity to do something for us. We do it on our own. Give you an example. Back in Washington, D.C., between June 7th and July 30th, 1993, violent crime dropped 23% due to a group that was practicing transcendental meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before the project, the police chief said that the only thing that would create a 20% drop in crime would be 20 inches of snow. And by violent crime, we're talking about homicides, rapes, aggravated assaults. And when the project disbanded, in other words, when this group of meditators gave up the project and moved on, crime rose again. Native American shamans and medicine people use their intentions to change weather patterns. Healers use intention when they're working with their clients. And so I don't think we can discount just how powerful a collective experience of focusing the will can be.
Okay, thank you, Michael. So maybe, just maybe, we had a little influence on that. We'll keep doing more of these. Archaeologists clashed at a conference in Egypt over a theory that secret burial chambers could be hidden behind the walls of King Tut's tomb. Speaking at a conference, and he has somehow arisen, former antiquities minister and famed Egyptologist Zahi Hawass rejected the theory that undiscovered chambers lie behind the tomb and likely contain the tomb of Nefertiti, one of Egypt's most famous figures. The theory has prompted new exploration, and it has been extensively scanned by readers. It's kind of interesting that Zahi seems to be showing up again in Egypt. Today, Mercury passed directly between Earth and the Sun, producing a very rare transit of Mercury's inky black disk across the solar surface. There are pictures all over the internet of that. It's fascinating. Up next, how enlightenment can change your brain. Dr. Andrew Newberg joins us along with Mark Robert Waldman next on Coast to Coast AM. How enlightenment changes your brain. We've got two special guests for you this hour. Dr. Andrew Newberg, of course, back with us, neuroscientist who studies the relationship between brain function and various mental states. He is a pioneer in the neurological study of religious and spiritual experiences. It's a field known as neurotheology. And his research includes taking brain scans of people in prayer, meditation, rituals, and trance states. Let's first of all bring in Dr. Andrew Newberg. Andrew, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back on your program.
I'm looking forward to this. And our other guest, he's going to be with us for the first couple hours here, Mark Robert Waldman, executive MBA faculty at Loyola Marymount University. He teaches neuroleadership programs. He's one of the world's leading experts on communication, spirituality, and the brain. Mark, it's good to have you with us.
Glad to join you.
Now, let's start with you, Dr. Newberg. We've only got you for the hour, so I want to take advantage of this wonderful opportunity we've got with you. Tell me a little bit about the brain scans of people in prayer meditation. What have you seen with those?
Well, in general, we've seen lots of different changes that occur when people are meditating or praying. There's not just one part of the brain that turns on or turns off that's associated with those kinds of practices. It really seems like the whole brain becomes involved, and that makes a lot of sense when you think about what meditation and prayer ultimately do. They affect our thoughts, our feelings, our beliefs. So it would make sense that there are lots of different areas of our brain that become involved. And we've had a good fortune to be able to study a couple hundred people doing all different kinds of practices using a variety of different brain imaging tools. So we can try to look into the brain and see what it's doing and see what areas of the brain are actually affected. For example, we've often found an area of the brain, for example, the parietal lobe, which is located in the back of the brain, which is very involved in helping us to create our sense of self and to orient that self in the world. That's a part of our brain that actually starts to quiet down a lot of times when we meditate or pray, as a person loses their sense of self and feels that sense of space go away, that they feel the sense of oneness going on. And that, so we see these kinds of changes reflected in an area of our brain that normally tries to create our sense of self. As that area shuts down, we lose that sense of self. So this is how we start to put together all the different areas of the brain and how it's related to our experiences that are associated with our spirituality and our religious beliefs.
Okay, and Mark, you wrote a book, of course, called How God Changes Your Brain. And, of course, this one called How Enlightenment Changes Your Brain as well. Tell me how you got involved in this.
Well, back in 2003, I was stumbling around working on an anthology called Reinventing God. And I came across Andy Newberg's writings on why God won't go away from his first book. And I just couldn't excerpt anything from his book. So I called up Andy, and I said, Andy, can I take a little bit of your book and a little bit of your research and weave it together into a new article? And he said, yes. And we began to talk, and we discovered something very interesting, and we've had a kind of a catchphrase going on, which is that Andy can't write and I can't think. So we make a perfect team. So I began to become involved with Andy, both in terms of doing neuroscience research with him and also being a test subject in several of the experiments going on. We've been working together now for about 12 or 13 years and co-authoring quite a lot of books.
And Andy, are we talking, Dr. Newberg, is there a science behind all of this with the brain function, or are we talking about something a little more metaphysical, or is it a combination of both?
I think it's a combination of both. Obviously, with a brain scan, we can see what's going on. We can see the biological effects of these kinds of practices and experiences, and that's an important part. You know, when you think about meditation or prayer and how they affect us, how they affect our psychology, how they affect our biology, that's real, and that's something that's important and something that we can study. But as Mark and I have explored these topics, especially as you understand the kinds of experiences that people have, there's often descriptions of experiences that seem to go beyond what science can measure, at least right now. And that's part of the discussion too. And I think part of what, you know, we always have to realize is what is the limitations of science and what does that tell us about the nature of these experiences? Can there be more to these experiences than purely the biology? Can it have a lot to do with human consciousness and will and intention? In fact, in our most recent book, How Enlightenment Changes Your Brain, we have a whole spectrum of human consciousness that we discuss as a way of helping us to better understand these experiences, realizing that the biology is an important part of it, but that there may be something far beyond that as well.
Are you finding in your studies that certain people will possess different kinds of brain scans based on how they act, how they pray, how they meditate?
Well, there's definitely differences in the brain depending on the kind of practice that a person does. So, for example, a very common kind of meditation practice is when somebody concentrates on something, when they concentrate on a sacred object, a prayer, a phrase, a mantra, or something like that. And when people do that kind of a practice, we tend to find similarities across those types of people. And even if you're from a different tradition, if you're a Christian or a Buddhist, if you're concentrating on something, then you tend to activate certain patterns of brain activity in a similar kind of way. But then there are other practices, for example, some of the Sufi practices or Pentecostal speaking in tongues, where, for example, instead of concentrating on something, the whole goal of the experience of the practice is to actually let go your concentration, to kind of surrender to the experience. And when that happens, we see a completely different kind of pattern of activity. In fact, one of the areas, a very important area of our brain, the frontal lobe, it turns on when we're concentrating. So when people are doing a concentration technique, their frontal lobes become more active. But when a person is engaged in speaking in tongues or feeling that they've surrendered to God, the frontal lobe activity actually drops down. It decreases because they don't feel like they're purposely making it happen. It's kind of happening to them.
And Mark, why does prayer seem to work? Because I'm pretty sure it does.
Well, what we've found, and we have a special chapter in our new book, How Enlightenment Changes the Brain, where Andy found a Muslim practitioner. He was kind of secular. He wasn't that particularly religious, but in Islamic practice, you're supposed to do this ritual prayer that begins with Bismillah, Ar-Rahman, Ar-Rahim, Alhamdulillah, and you do this ritual prayer five times a day. And Andy took him into the brain scan machine, and we didn't see much happening at all. And so our hypothesis was that if you just do something out of habit, whether it be a prayer or a meditation, if you just repeat some belief over and over and over in your head, but you don't really throw yourself totally into it, not much happens at all. And I find that most people who go to church, they don't really become totally immersed in the sacred activities or the spiritual practices that usually create most religions. So what would happen if you really threw yourself into it? Let's say you deepened your breathing, deepened your intention, as you had mentioned earlier, and you threw yourself into it. And Andy and Ibrahim, as we called him, had a remarkable experience. Very interesting shifts took place in the brain, and Andy can explain more detail what that was. But the experience moved him much more so. It became really important. So this teaches us something. Don't just sit and do prayers out of habit because somebody told you so. Do these prayers, do these meditations because you want to break out of your everyday consciousness. You want to enter another state of awareness where you can experience life more fully, or maybe find some deeper truth than what our limited brains can see.
Do you find major changes, Dr. Newberg, in people's brains based on some of these things they do?
Well, as Mark was just saying, I think part of what happens is that when people really engage practices that they feel strongly about, when they truly get into these practices, then we do see all kinds of changes. Now, I mean, interestingly, the brain itself has a fairly limited range, and by that I mean that when you talk, we usually are looking at a measure of blood flow in the brain. It's a measure of activity in the brain. Usually that isn't going to increase by 10 times. It's going to increase by maybe, 20% is a pretty substantial increase or decrease. So those are the kinds of magnitude of changes that we're seeing. But when people engage these practices, we can see that level of change. And what's also been fascinating to us is to observe the more permanent effects of these practices on people. So when we've taken people who start to do a practice, maybe they've never really done much of a meditation practice. This was a study that we had done about a couple of years ago where we took people who never really did a meditation program and we put them on a program for just 8 weeks. When they only did it for about 12 to 15 minutes a day. When they did that practice, we saw significant changes occurring in their brain, even when their brain was at rest. So it literally does change the brain, and it was changing the brain in areas that helped to support our memory functions, our attention functions, and also a very central structure in our brain, something called the thalamus, which helps to really help us create our sense of reality. It helps to bring in our sensory information, helps different parts of our brain communicate with each other, and this area of the brain seems to shift fairly significantly just as the result of doing these kinds of practices. And of course, if you could see these kinds of shifts occurring in somebody over an 8-week period of time, you can imagine what's going on in the brain of the monks and the nuns who may be doing these practices for hours a day for 30 years, 40 years.
If you compare the brain scans of a monk to someone like a Ted Bundy serial killer, would you see a difference?
Well, absolutely, you would see a difference, although, interestingly, I don't think the data is strong enough yet on truly understanding what goes on in the criminal brain, in brains that don't fully work well. We see differences, and in fact, some of the areas that we tend to see abnormalities in include our frontal lobes, so that people, they don't think about things properly, they don't plan things properly, their emotional systems are all out of whack. So there's a lot of differences in the brains themselves, but the specific patterns are always a little, there's not one clear pattern for criminals, for example, but usually what you're seeing is a brain that is not in balance, is out of whack, that doesn't look right, whereas when people get involved in practices like meditation and prayer, their brain functions wind up taking on very positive kinds of changes that support the emotional processes of the brain, the cognitive processes of the brain, and ultimately, as our more qualitative data shows, these kinds of practices really enhance a person's life. They reduce anxiety and depression. They improve memory. They improve the ability of the person to think clearly. They can improve their sense of spirituality, sense of meaning and purpose in life. So all of these things are things that can ultimately happen if you engage these practices.
Okay, hold on with us, Doctor, and you, Mark, as well. We're going to come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM as we talk about how enlightenment changes your brain. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you, with Dr. Andrew Newberg, who is with us to the rest of this hour. Mark Robert Waldman is with us next hour as well to take your calls. We're talking about their joint work called How Enlightenment Changes Your Brain. And Dr. Newberg, let me ask you, does nice music alter the brain as well?
Well, nice music alters the brain. Basically everything alters the brain. But when you think about, we actually did a study where we compared some of the practices like meditation and prayer to just listening to music, listening to Mozart, for example. Both of them change the brain. Usually when you're looking at music, it's changing some of the emotional areas of the brain. It helps to calm us down a little bit. But it doesn't create nearly the complex type of processes and patterns of activity that we see in the brain when a person is doing a practice, a spiritual practice like meditation or prayer, something that can ultimately lead them to an experience of enlightenment. There you're starting to see many different parts of the brain turning on, getting involved in the process, not just one or two. And that's what you talked about, the science of all of this. And part of how we piece together what we think goes on in the brain is by looking at what happens in the brain during a variety of other types of tasks, and whether it's concentrating or listening to music or having emotions, and then realizing that when we actually engage these kinds of profound practices and experiences, that we see lots of different parts of the brain turning on in a very coordinated kind of process. So it's definitely something that goes far beyond just kind of the basic ways in which we use our brain to listen to music, to think about things. It's something much more profound than that.
There's a great story about mediums when they try to channel the dead. What happens to them in their brain, and does that give us any proof of life and death?
Well, when we studied a group of Brazilian mediums, what we found was that there were significant changes in the brain. And for example, one of the areas that we focused on a lot, we were talking about in the last segment, is the frontal lobe, which normally helps us to feel like we can concentrate and focus and purposely make things happen. When we looked at the trance states that these mediums got themselves into, where they try to open themselves up to being connected to the spirit world, their frontal lobe activity decreased. They felt like they weren't making it happen. It was something that was really happening to them, and the changes in the brain reflect that kind of an experience. Now, as I always like to tell people, you know, when we look at the brain scans of people doing any kind of practice, it tells us what's going on in their brain when they have that experience or when they're doing that particular practice. Same thing with the mediums. All it's telling us is what's going on in the brain when they do that practice. Whether they are actually connecting to the dead, that's not something that we specifically see in the brain scan. We can't tell that. We can't say that they're not.
Right.
We can't say that it's just in the brain, but we also can't prove that there's something more than what's going on in the brain.
But you can tell that the brain is showing some kind of change.
Oh, absolutely. Some very important changes and very profound changes that distinguish these kinds of practices from others.
And Mark, for people who want to exercise their brain and get it into this different kind of state, what are some of the things that you both recommend?
Well, we start out, you can do, all you have to do if you really want to create the most radical change in your brain is to start breathing deeply right now, inhaling, exhaling. You're going to start firing up all kinds of areas throughout your brain. If you do this for 11 minutes, you'll start hallucinating. And that's not necessarily a pleasant experience. In fact, we find that many people have gone off into Eastern practices where they have some very intense types of ritual chanting, where you're listening to repetitive music or drumming, doing shamanic dancing while you're chanting and doing body movements and rituals. And in 5 or 10 minutes, you can find yourself in an altered state of consciousness that feels like an LSD or a psychedelic experience. If you're not prepared for that, you actually begin to think, maybe I'm nuts or psychotic. So what Andy proposed in this particular book is that we know that a certain kind of meditation will raise activity, that 20% that he mentioned, in like your frontal lobe and your parietal lobe. But then what would happen if you shifted your practice and did something that caused your frontal lobe activity and parietal lobe activity to radically drop another 20%? Here you can have as much as a 40% change in the brain. And this is where your entire worldview begins to collapse. Your language centers can shut down. So one of the things we're looking at this research and saying, all right, can I turn this into practical exercises that are useful? So for example, one way to bring the brain into a very calm, relaxed state is to yawn 3, 4, 5 times. Yawning has been proven to be a way to cool an overactive metabolism in the brain. So just consciously yawning 2, 3, 4 times, you'll begin to feel yourself slowing down and slowing down and slowing down. This turns out to be very excellent if a person's feeling a tremendous amount of stress or anxiety. So this is what I actually teach to our executive MBA students every year at Loyola Marymount University. We start out in a class, and all I do is stand in the front of the classroom and I ring a bell like this. And I ask them,
that woke me up.
Yes, I've woken you up. And as the bell fades away, all I do is sit there and remain completely silent. And people are thinking, okay, what kind of idiot is this? This is an accounting class. This is for people, busy managers running, multi-million dollar companies. And then I ask them to listen to that bell again. But first I ask them to yawn and stretch very slowly. It brings you into the present moment. All of your thoughts begin to slow down. You can actually shut off the language centers in your brain by doing this. And I ring that bell again, and I ask everyone, listen to that bell as deeply as you possibly can. And as the sound of the bell fades away, you have to listen harder and harder and harder. You're doing, in essence, a concentration meditation, as Andy had described earlier. Then, when you can no longer hear the bell, like right, let's take this moment of silence right now, and you listen to this silence. The longer you listen to that silence, the harder you concentrate, the more you begin to hear all kinds of other sounds in the room. You become aware of your own breathing. And this we find, if you just do this 60 seconds once each hour, so you set up like a mindfulness bell app on your phone or your computer, when you hear that bell sound, just take 10 seconds to yawn, stretch, listen to the sound of the bell, and what happens in less than 60 seconds, you can get rid of all of the mental stress built up in your busy workday, stress levels go down, and suddenly your work productivity goes up. So we want you to prepare your brain by going into a really deep state of relaxation. But now we can do something in a different direction. So for example, we discovered in people who were doing the sound of om, that the same thing happened when Pentecostals were speaking in tongues and when the Brazilian mediums were putting themselves in these deep trance states. And the experimenters of this study, they had the people do S sound, and nothing happened. So we knew it's the sound. So that vibration begins to turn off activity in the frontal lobe. When that happens, and this is really cool if you do this with a whole group of people. I had a chance to do this with 1,500 people in the audience one time. And you think all of this om sound, and you just get pulled into this. I mean, you lose your sense of self. Everything kind of disappears. You don't even know that you're there for a moment. Now, you've raised the energy back up. You lower it down. You raise it up. You lower it down. What we found happens, and Andy can talk more about this with the 2,000 survey participants, is that all of your belief systems get suspended. Whatever you were believing in, God, politics, whatever it is, it all falls away for a moment. You're totally free of all beliefs. Think about that. Think about what it would be like to not have any beliefs about anything. You're just in this total state of awareness. And in that state, This is where those aha experiences come up that some people call enlightenment, where suddenly you see a problem in a brand new way, just like what Einstein would do when he did these brain exercises and mind games, and then he would take a nap. You take a nap, you go into this daydreaming state, and you find out that there are parts of your brain deep down inside in the anterior cingulate and insula that's solving problems in its own language.
In your sleep state.
In a daydreaming state.
Yeah.
Even when you're sleeping, what we seem to know now about sleep is that this is the brain solving problems it couldn't solve during the daytime. So again, with my executive MBA students, we ask them to concentrate for the next hour, and then when they hear that bell, they yawn and stretch, and then we just say, go ahead and let your mind wander, let it daydream, but watch where it wanders. And many times, if you have a specific problem and you ask yourself, I need a solution to this. I don't know how to deal with my wife. She's bugging me. Okay, I'm going to breathe very deeply. I'm going to raise my energy up. I'm then going to yawn and stretch. It's going to go down. I'm going to go om or make another sound or just create a movement ritual like rocking my body back and forth and back and forth. My sense of self disappears. All of my anger and fears and anxieties fall away, and I'm in this very cool, altered state place. Now I can ask my intuition, again, a process that takes place in your anterior cingulate and insula, any question you want, and you'll hear this little whisper. It's like you have your own inner wisdom voice, and people who are religious oftentimes feel that that's the voice of God. And from my perspective, this is just a natural neurological process. There is a God within you that gives you clear, calm advice. And this is how we teach people how to use these meditations to enter all kinds of altered states so that they can solve problems on their own. You save $1 million instead of going to a therapist.
Why does it seem that consciousness seems to exist outside of the physical brain?
Well,
we think
because the brain doesn't have a way to even see what the outside world is. One of the most amazing discoveries that Andy Newberg and I both have is that the brain can only experience its own inner workings. For example, we see color, right? But open up your kid's behavioral psychology textbook, and you find out that color doesn't exist in the world. Light waves exist, but who's ever seen a light wave?
Right.
So our eyes respond to light waves. A signal is sent back into our visual cortex. That's where color is created, and that's where contrast and shapes are created. And here's what's really amazing. All that information, the picture in the back of your head, never makes it to your frontal lobes where consciousness is. And we've been able to identify where everyday consciousness is. And if you take your two fingers and put them right above your eyes on either side, this is a little tiny area in your prefrontal cortex called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. And this is where consciousness occurs. And consciousness is a very simple thing. It's 4 to 7 chunks of information held in working memory. So, for example, if I was to ask you to repeat back to me any of the sentences I've just said with any degree of accuracy, can you do that?
Yeah, some of them. Some of them.
Try it. Say one thing that either Andy or I have said.
Well, you talked about memory. You mean verbatim? No,
yes.
I couldn't do it verbatim.
So, but this one you'll remember. You can only consciously recall 10 words or less. Now, anybody can give that back to me, right? That's
why is that?
That's what consciousness is. It only holds a little bit of information, and then it gets rid of it and pulls another bunch of information forward. Now, when you ask the question why, this is the curious thing about neuroscience. It never answers the question why. It simply tells you how or what or where. So what we're finding, though, is that if you use some of these enlightenment exercises that we put into the book, whether it be yawning or stretching or repeating a word that has deep meaning to you, like peace or love or whatever word has deep value to you, what happens is that we begin to see the area of consciousness in your frontal lobes begin to expand. You're broadening your awareness, and you begin to see the world outside of your language-based consciousness. That's why I say we have like six different levels of consciousness, just instinctual gut level reactions to the world. And then there's all the habitual ways in which we behave. We don't pay attention to how we brush our teeth when we brush our teeth. And then we have this little tiny bit of everyday consciousness that I've been talking about. But then the brain gets tired from focusing, and it goes automatically into this daydreaming state. Now it's called the default mode. This is that state of incredible creativity and awareness. And if you learn how to watch it using mindfulness, just to sit there and watch how your thoughts and feelings continually pop in and out of consciousness, you become aware of something remarkable. You begin to realize that you are not your thoughts or your feelings. And you go, wow, that's really cool. If I'm not my thoughts and feelings, if I think I'm having a terrible time, that's just a thought. It's not really true. It's not really happening in the world. And then you say, well, this is interesting. I'm watching myself thinking. And now you start watching the self that's watching the self, and you have kind of like a brain fart, and everything stops. And in that moment, that's what we think is part of the enlightenment experience. You begin to become aware that there's so much more going on in the world and in your own brain and in your own mind than you were consciously aware of the moment before. And that's a big aha experience. That's what we're saying is a step along the path of enlightenment.
Do you find, too, that people, Doctor, who are a little more positive about life as opposed to those who are negative tend to have better brain function?
Well, absolutely. When people have a more positive way of looking at things, when people embrace positive emotions, that does enhance the way our brain works. And in fact, when we talk about the enlightenment experience itself, it usually is so overwhelmingly positive that people report not only the experience of enlightenment, but improvements in their sense of well-being, their sense of meaning and purpose in life, how they handle their relationships, their jobs, and so forth. And the evidence points to the fact that not only do we feel all of this happening, we feel the improvements in the functioning going on, but that it literally happens in the brain itself, that when we have a variety, when we embrace our positive emotions, it enables our neural connections to work better. We release neurotransmitters that help to enhance the brain's functioning, that help to create more connections between the nerve cells and so forth. Whereas when you have negative emotions and you try to embrace fear or anger or anxiety, these actually wind up being detrimental to the brain. It releases stress hormones that actually damage the connections in the brain, and the brain ultimately works far less. So that the more you focus on these negative emotions and pessimism, the worse your brain actually works. And of course, the other thing that Mark and I have talked a lot about in several of our books, including How Enlightenment Changes Your Brain, is the notion that whatever particular perspective you take, the more you focus on it, the more that becomes the way your brain actually works. So the more you focus on those positive emotions, the more positive your brain becomes and the better it works. The more you focus on negative ideas and negative feelings and emotions, then the more your brain continues to work in that negative way. It really depends a lot on the approach that you wind up taking that winds up leading you down a path towards a brain that is very positive and very connected and working very well, versus a brain that isn't working very well.
Okay, well, next hour, Mark Robert Waldman will stay with us to take your phone calls and maybe your stories on how enlightenment changes your own brain. Dr. Andrew Newberg, of course, needs to move on. Thank you, Doctor. Appreciate you being on the program. And, of course, we'll be back with Mark in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM as we continue talking about the ability to use your brain. Phone lines are opened. And also don't forget to like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter as much as you can, because lots of great information exists. For example, this program was highlighted on Twitter tonight.